connecting to the internet.
Internet.
Networking software.
World Wide Web for the web. Computer today.
Computer.
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 NetSurfer Pro.
Hey, so this is NetSurfer Pro, a whirlwind ride through the World Wide Web, and I'm your host, Matthew Marissa.
And as always, it's your co-host, Galen.
Galen, there's something different about you, and I can't quite put... Did you get a new haircut?
Well, you know, I did get a bit of a haircut. I've bedecked my hair with some gold flakes, and I've put on my Sunday best suit with, you know, the first three buttons unbuttoned.
Mm-hmm.
The first three and the last three, of course.
Yeah, only the middle two are buttoned.
Yep. And I have put on a big blazer that is green with dollar signs,
mm-hmm.
and pants that match the blazer,
mm-hmm.
And a big tie that
Dude,
says...
Do the pants match the blazer?
And a big tie that says Money Boy, but the M has dollar sign strike-throughs. It's very confusing.
So, okay, hold on. I swear I've seen that in a video game. Is this like a... Final Fantasy? No.
Yes.
It's like a Sims thing? No, that's a different symbol.
Oh, you're thinking of Richard.
Richard.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, what's the deal? Did you, like, suddenly just get $1 billion or something?
Well, you could say that I've gotten something recently. I've been living kind of a bougier lifestyle because I have happened into a steamed deck.
Oh, that's why there's all this mist everywhere.
Yes.
What, are you like, is there like a bath below us that's boiling?
Yes.
It was really hot.
Yeah, we're actually recording this in a sauna right now. This is my personal sauna.
It's a bit more wet than most saunas, I'm to be honest.
You know, I tried to recreate the steam deck and I ended up with the sauna, which I guess, it's a deck that gets steamy. I guess it makes sense. But, you know, I've been living that steamed life. All of my clothes here are, of course, steam pressed.
Mm-hmm.
I have a humidifier and an extra humidifier in my room.
Mm-hmm.
I have taken 3 showers a day.
And let me guess, Stanley is here too?
Yes, Stanley the steamer. The
and his brother Cleveland.
So, the esteemed Stanley steamer. He keeps your carpets cleaner, so I hear.
So I hear. So I've been told, and some choose to believe it.
So yes, I have actually been given access to a Steam Deck. It's mine. I did not purchase it myself. A friend ended up giving it to me. They bought the Switch OLED, the Steam Deck OLED, and it ended up being a present for a good while ago. I've had it, but I've only really been actively really using it recently, and I wanted to just talk about it a little bit, because it is a staggeringly good machine.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't know what the Steam Deck is, imagine a Switch that is all compact, like a Switch Lite sort of thing, except that it is big, chunky, and it plays pretty much all of the PC games you would want to play on it.
Most of the PC games.
Most of the PC games you would want to play on it. There is an upper limit. I believe my friend has said that, like, hardware-wise, it is about as powerful as something like a PS4, which, one, is insane to think about, that I can hold a PS4 in my hands.
I can hold a PS4 in my hands. I can't play it at the same time, but, like, that's kind of a big portion of the PS4 is its ability to pick it up.
New for the PlayStation 6. Not only have we gone digital for all the games, we've got digital for the console as well.
Oh no, it's Amazonic!
Now you just buy a controller that's $400 and it comes preloaded with all your favorite games, like Pac-Man for the NES.
Barf boy.
$7,000 dad. Yeah, it is a really interesting little machine. It's basically just, it is essentially a pre-jailbroken, like, system in that it's, you know, it has the Steam, like, big picture overlay for the front end, But at any point, you can hold the power button and be like, hey, I'd like this to become basically a desktop PC. And it'll be like, okay, switching to PC mode. It does run a, like, specific Linux.
Proton, I believe?
Yeah, it's Proton. I believe that normally it runs Proton. I might have a slightly different, like, he might have put a different OS on it.
Oh, okay.
That said, I'm not going to specifically say that it does, because I'm not entirely certain.
Either way.
Either way. So, yes, it plays most games that I have wanted it to run. For as an example, I could pretty easily run Dark Souls 3. I know that Elden Ring, I believe, plays very well with it. Street Fighter 6, I would say, is... So Street Fighter 6 is rated for the Steam Deck. I think it might be rated for the very slightly hardware better Steam Deck. Because the actual, like, the original version Steam Deck, it runs a little slow. Like, it actively slows down during the heavier crowd sections. However, I don't mind that, because as a fighting game, that's literally an advantage.
Also, like, heavier crowd sections don't come up a ton in Street Fighter VI.
See,
it's like World Tour mode, and I guess the lobbies.
Yeah, basically. Like... I'm sure that if I were to play it as an actual fighting game on the deck, it would probably not have too many issues. But, like... Because I mostly use it for the World Tour mode, which is, by the way, great. We're probably going to do an episode on that game at some point. There are sections where it's usually facing, like, a specific background, a strip mall or something like that, where it works perfectly. You know, no slowdown. The moment that it pitches to the side so that you can see a bunch of NPCs, like, yo, there's a street fight going on, then it, like... half frame rate sometimes. It is
the little golden eye lag.
Yeah, it's got that N64 lag. But again, technically speaking, it helps me, so I don't even mind it that much. I used it to play today's game, of course, mostly in the back half. I actually had the fun experience of going from playing on desktop with a controller to playing on Steam Deck, and can generally confirm that the Steam Deck is nice and comfortable and does everything you would want it to do. Yeah, I could probably go on for a while, because I use it for emulation as well. It emulates up to the PS3 pretty well. PS2 and backwards, GameCube, Xbox, all that perfectly fine. PS3, it is very case by case. That is also probably because PS3 emulation just isn't there fully yet. PS3 emulation is still kind of being worked on. I believe that 360 weirdly has worked better from what I've seen, although I haven't gotten the 360 emulator running yet, so darn.
One of the issues with that is just that that's the point where things started to be ported to PC pretty well.
Yeah.
So, like, it's become less of a reason for preservation's sake.
Yeah, basically.
Unless you want to play, like, Splosion Man or something.
Yeah, gotta play that XBLA lineup. Play some stacking. Who out here trying to play From Dust, huh?
I'm pretty sure I have stacking on PC.
I had stacking on 360. I 100%ed that game and the DLC. That was a great game.
Stacking just proves we need Lego Hitman.
True. Okay. Very true. Yeah, yeah. But the Steam Deck overall, if I had paid my own money for it, I might have been very slightly disappointed. But at the same time, I would still be using it every day. It is very nice if you are on the fence about whether or not you will buy it or use it. I think that it is staggeringly handy for actually getting me to play through some of my backlog. Because otherwise I'm like, I don't want to sit at my desk for an hour to play fucking Torchlight.
You don't have to play Torchlight.
You don't have to play
Torchlight. Play Torchlight 2 and then don't play any of the other ones. Also, you could just play Path of Exile instead.
Yeah, play Fate, the game that's kids' Torchlight.
So, I think it's really funny talking about Steam Deck because, like, I feel like, at least in the circles I run, when I hear people talk about it, it's almost always in the context of, like, Vampire Survivors or Balatro or Slay the Spire.
Oh,
like, it is
an
enabler more than anything else. I hear people use it to play all these, like, roguelites and, you know, run-based games. And I'm like, I am kind of jealous because I do wish I had some of those on my phone. But at the same time, I would just be lugging it everywhere and I would get so distracted.
Yeah.
Like, I would play so much Isaac on it, but I would probably play too much Isaac on it, you know?
I will say, it has definitely enabled my Balatro addiction.
Mm-hmm.
Balatro being the roguelike deck builder that was made for me specifically.
Yeah, it's one of the current hotnesses. We're not going to talk about it this week.
This week?
This week. Wink, wink.
Yeah, it definitely is a good enabler for a lot of roguelites, or, you know, the games that you can sink 100 million hours into.
Okusenmon.
Okusenmon. Okusenmon.
Yeah. I will say, I was on a plane for quite a while this past week, and I played on my Switch, I played through more of Smurpage, and found I was really overleveled, but I wish I had a Steam Deck just so I could play, like, Isaac, like I said. Yeah. Or Balatro. I saw someone playing Balatro in the airport, and I was like, oh, I'm so jealous.
Yeah. I will also say that the version that comes with lower capacity, it's handy to have the higher capacity, but realistically, you're probably just going to put a 1 terabyte SD card in the thing anyway, so you don't strictly need it.
I wish I had a 1 terabyte SD card. That's fucking huge.
Yeah, they fit it into a really tiny card nowadays. Have mm-hmm. you seen? Have you seen how small cards are these days? I try to play Magic these days, and it's like dust.
It's like you need a magnifying glass to even see the mana cost.
Yeah.
Sorry, they call it mana value now. I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah, of course. CMV, converted mana value.
But as you said, you had used the Steam Deck to play the game we're talking about today, and we are going to talk about that game today.
Yes.
Now, which is to say, we're talking about this game called Pseudo Regalia.
The Fact Corner.
So Pseudo Regalia was released last year in 2023 by I believe just a one-person team of someone named Ritzler with two eyes. Great name.
Yeah, very good name, even beyond even before the Riz, like Rizzler.
Well, it's Ritz. So, you know, they're putting on.
They're putting on the Ritz.
Yeah. Pseudo Regalia is a very fun game. It was kind of niche when it came out. It had some, I guess, sort of negative traits and a lot of positive traits, but it's very interesting, and we're going to use it more of like a springboard to talk about other stuff. But first, let's just go over the game.
Yeah, so what is Pseudo Regalia?
Okay, let's get the big elephant out of the way, or should I say the goat cat lady?
Yeah, the goat cat bunny lady.
Yeah, so this is a furry game.
Yeah.
You play as a furry. In this case, it's a girl named Sybil, and she is like a jackalope.
Yeah.
Like bunny ears, horns, fur, kind of a bunny tail.
Like goat. I don't know if she has goat hooves, but like she has a lot of goat DNA in her, not just appointed by the game, but also because, like, you know, kicking is a major theme.
You know, there's a part where like a syringe pulls out like a blood sample and then they run her DNA and it's like, wow, Sybil, you are 30% goat, 30% rabbit, and what's the rest of the numbers? 35% cat, which I don't really see, but like it's in there. And then the 5% is mystery.
And then 5% luck, I believe.
20% skill.
Skill, yeah.
Yeah. So Sybil has thick thighs. Let's move on.
Yeah. Yeah. Sybil.
Look, if you are appalled by furry characters, you won't play this game.
Yeah.
I am sorry. The camera does zoom in on her thighs and butt a little too often.
It's definitely intentional, but at the same time, like, honestly, I think Sybil's design is kind of lovely beyond just, haha, it's hot.
It's
like,
a good design.
Yeah, it's a really, really good design, really dapper, really fun, a lot of fun outfits as well. There used to be just one extra outfit, apparently, but in the map update, they added, like, 5 different outfits you can choose.
Yeah, you can unlock them by completing different challenges, and there's some really good ones and some that are equally revealing. It's like, it's not explicit, you know? It's not showing nipple.
My favorite thing about the game is that the starting gear is probably the most revealing gear.
Yeah.
Like, every other suit puts on more clothes onto Sybil.
Yeah. It's just pretty funny.
Yeah. But, like, you know, at the same time, I wouldn't necessarily... It's the kind of thing where if it came out in a context 10 years ago, I would look at that and not even necessarily associated it, like, not even necessarily associated with, you know, furry. It's just, you know, it's a really good design. She's not wearing pants, but that's a common cartoony design.
Okay, but, like, she has, like, a leotard on.
Yeah, she has like, a leotard on. She's got the collar and the, like, vest and stuff. It is very...
It's Playboy Bunny
yeah,
coded.
Yeah, it's very Playboy Bunny coded. But
that's what I'm... Look, I get it. It's a good design, but we can't ignore that there are people who will be turned off by it and people who are very turned on by it. That is... I just need to get that out of the way, because, like, I feel like... So, I play Rivals of Aether, the furry platform fighter.
Yes.
There are people who will not touch anything furry, even if it is not, like, sexualized furry. And then, the higher on the scale it goes to that limit, the less likely they are to play that game.
Yeah.
It's a thing to discuss because, like, it is both the furry community that is sort of responsible for some aspects, the way characters are depicted in games made by members of those communities, the amount of sexualization for other characters and certain clothes and stuff like that, and sort of if there is a double standard for furries versus just, like, I don't know, fucking Chun-Li or Cammy.
Yeah.
You know Cammy?
Yeah.
Sybil is essentially wearing what Cammy wears.
Yeah. I mean, they de-sexed Cammy in some of the later games. Not de-sexed okay. Cammy, but, you know.
They put clothes on her, but she still looks fine, she's, you know? Yeah. She's still a street...
Less heavily sexualized.
Capcom knows how to make character designs. Look, it's a complicated topic, because, like, you think about just sort of the role that sort of sexualized clothing plays in society, you know, to get all... I feel like I can't say society in a non-ironic way.
Yeah.
But, like... You know, it's a complicated issue because it's both going over, like, what is considered too much, but also how that is determined by very, like, puritanical traditions.
Yeah.
And how those have shifted over time and how different, like, internet communities are challenging that, not out of perversion, but out of, like, social progress.
Yeah.
Challenging traditions because sometimes traditions don't need to remain. That being said... Like what I'm getting at is that this character design is probably too sexualized for some people, probably nothing for some people,
yeah.
You know, not a big deal, and it's going to come up in conversation with this game.
Yeah.
It's unavoidable. I can't help but say that. I feel like it has to be just immediately out of the way, boilerplate, like first stop on the ride.
My take is, if you do not like her character design, there's an accessibility option to give her pants. You should play the game anyway. It's very good and $6. But...
Okay, so, the gameplay.
The gameplay of this game is some of the most active, fun movement I have played in a video game.
Yeah. So, the game is a sort of 3D Metroidvania, 3D platformer, very exploration-focused, where you're in sort of a big castle, dungeon-y sort of vibe with different rooms with doors that connect each other, and the actual route you take is mostly non-linear, but you unlock different abilities that upgrade your movement options, give you new movement options, give you some attacks, and those open up new pathways for you to take. There is a final boss... And to reach the final boss, you have to gather six keys. Hidden,
five keys? 5 keys.
You have to gather 5 keys hidden throughout the castle. And usually this will require getting all the abilities, or at least the main movement and attack options. There are some, like, side upgrades that aren't necessary to beat the game. But you can get these keys in pretty much any order once you've gotten all the movement abilities. And you don't always get the abilities in the same order from run to run. There are a lot of options, some of which are very intentional by the developer, which leads to a game that is, it rewards sort of both just a willing sense of exploration and patience in regarding exploration, but also a game that rewards multiple playthroughs as you get more familiar with the positions of everything.
Yeah.
You can be like, oh, I can reach this at this point, or I can go here at this point. It's not open world in the sense that there's not, like, a mountain that you can climb.
Yeah.
It's not, like, a big plains with a mountain and you can go on every square foot. It is a dungeon with rooms in bespoke hallways, but those hallways are in a more open web.
So the abilities that you're going to be unlocking, first, the first ability that you're going to end up with is the weapon. The weapon is a cross. She holds it upside down. It's super cool. It's more or less allows you to do your basic platformer three-hit combo. There's a little bit of, like, nuance here in that there is a later unlock that also increases the amount of damage you can do based on meter, but we're getting ahead of ourselves. So you got your weapon. Then after that, I believe Sungreaves is probably going to be the next one that most players get.
Yeah.
Sungreaves is your, like, dash. You hit left trigger, you dash forward. It opens up a lot more of your movement. It's kind of, I won't say it's the main, like, thing of the game, but I would definitely say that as far as going forward very fast, it's the thing you're going to end up doing.
Yeah.
It, in combination with, like, an ability that lets you jump out of dash, and if you get into speedrunning and stuff, then you know, have, like, a specific trick you can do, but...
We'll get to that later.
Again, we're getting to that later. After the Greaves, I believe next you'll usually get, like, you get Indignation, which is the ability that lets you do damage based on how much meter you have.
Right, so you gain... There is a super meter.
Yes.
You gain meter by hitting enemies, and...
It's more like a Hollow Knight meter.
Sort of, yeah.
It has three pips, and every one pip usually heals, like, an amount of
damage. Okay, yeah, so you can hold a button to heal up after a certain amount of time, and it is pretty much Hollow Knight, really. Yeah, because you can't move while you're holding the button to heal unless you get an ability that lets you walk very slowly, and it heals you for a little bit of health, but otherwise you're pretty vulnerable while healing. But then, yeah, there's an ability called Indignation that gives you passive benefits depending on how high your meter is.
Yeah. From there, it kind of branches out a little bit. Other abilities you get include the Cling Gem, which lets you hold right trigger to do basically a wall run. Usually it does it in kind of an arc that's, you know, the wall run arc. It goes up a little bit and then you start dipping down and then you start really dipping down. Every once in a while, you'll run into, like, a cylinder, which will just infinitely spin you up because... Having to deal with the falling down would probably be hell on cylinders.
Mm-hmm.
You have a ability that gives you a short projectile. It's not a short projectile. It's kind of it's mostly to hit switches and stuff. It doesn't really have a lot of combat use that much.
So, yeah, that's part of a, like, charge attack.
Yes.
Where you can hold the attack button to charge up your swing, and then you can break certain blocks with it, and it does more damage. And then you can upgrade that to gain the ability to throw a projectile when you charge attack.
Yes.
There's not... Okay, I want to go a bit further in just this bit that there aren't many enemies. There aren't many bosses either. There's, like, one main boss, a few mini bosses that are more or less just elite enemies that will appear later.
Yeah.
Most of the enemies you'll see, there's, like, four main types, and then there's a few, like... stronger enemies. You've got eggs, which don't do anything. They look like the eggs from Nights into Dreams.
Yep.
Keep that in mind. There are swords that will fly at you, and then there are trumpeters that will shoot you with, like, musical notes.
Yeah, they look like little axolotls. They're adorable.
They kind of remind me of Florges, or Floette, the Pokemon.
Floette, yes.
Or Flabébé. Whatever the flower fairy type thing is. That one.
The weird Floettes.
Then you have hands, which shoot out lightning from their finger.
Yep, they go like, bzzz, and then they throw, like, four projectiles at you.
Yeah, but you can kill those. And then the elite enemies
you can kill all of these enemies.
Sure, yeah. Then the elite enemies are the suits of armor, which are big and slow, and the maids that throw plates at you, and they have no head.
Yeah, so no head.
Mm-hmm.
The suits of armor as well die into a sword enemy, which is always fun to forget about.
Yeah. So those are pretty much the only enemies in the game.
Yeah.
And they're pretty sparse. I guess technically there's these, like, floating lamps that are mainly there to attack, because one of the upgrades...
Yes.
...lets you bounce off of things when you hit them with your aerial slash. Yeah.
Not to bring up Hollow Knight, because other games have done it, but feels very Hollow Knight in terms of usage.
Sort of, though you have to be beside something instead of above something.
Yes.
Yeah. There are these, like, foot claws that attach to the Greaves that let you wall kick. They do an air kick. It's really interesting. So a lot of early 3D platformers have an aerial move that's like an attack, but can be used for repositioning.
Yeah.
In Mario 64, it was the air kick, where he goes, hoo, and kicks. It's like not one you do a ton for damage. There's like, I think I-Rock it's good against, and that's mainly it. But like, it's really useful for careful spacing, and like, if you undershoot a platform, you can use the kick to go forward slightly.
Or if you overshoot a platform, you can use it to kind of like stop your momentum a bit and back up.
Banjo-Kazooie has both the like weird, not quite double jump, and it has the air attack that goes and pecks three times.
Yeah.
And then you can kind of, it's sort of similar with the spin in Mario Galaxy.
Yeah, the spin is a really good example.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The kicks in Pseudo-Regalia, they kind of let you do that. They also are like a wall jump mechanic where you can kick towards a wall and bounce off of it. However, you bounce on like the, it's like a tangent to where you are. So like essentially if you're facing a wall perpendicular, you will go away from it perpendicular. However, if you are parallel to a wall, you will continue forward when you kick it.
Yeah.
So it's based on the angle you are to the wall. I'm not sure the exact sort of trigonometry function that is working there. But if you play it, it's fairly intuitive.
Yeah, the intuitive is probably the best word I would use for this game. Like you said, the enemies themselves don't pose the most, like, they don't pose the most challenge for the most part, and so a lot of the challenge of the game, the most of the challenge of the game, arguably, is in the movement and in the platforming and in, you know, using the tools that the game gives you to either just do the platforming as they intend, or to try and, you know, skirt the rules of the game a little bit. Skip right. jumps and, you know, skip, zoom past entire sections and whatnot.
Right. There are three other abilities, just to finish out.
Yes.
There is the light that just makes your sword glow.
Yep.
Which is needed to, well, it's not needed, but it's helpful to traverse the pitch black section of, God, what is it called? It's like below the underbelly.
Oh, the something dungeon.
Yeah, the dilapidated dungeon.
Yeah, because that's the starting area as well, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Which we'll get to in a bit, the significance of that. Then there is the Stride Breaker, which is a ground slam from the air. You can also, like, jump out of it while you're in air, so you can do a little air backflip.
Yep, and if you ground pound, as it were, you can get a super jump after.
Yeah, and it's used to break breakable floors.
Yeah.
And then there is the aforementioned, like, Solar Winds, I think it's called, which lets you jump out of your slide doing a, like, forward dive. So combine that with the slide, and you can chain, like, slide, forward jump, and then you can, like, bunny hop after that, which keeps your momentum if you jump shortly after landing.
Yeah.
So, like, you can go really fast from that.
Plus, the kicks themselves that you can do, the game specifies that the earlier you do them, the like, longer they will be.
Yeah.
And so you use the kicks a lot when you are doing long momentum.
Yeah, you can use those to carry yourself further. And then there's also the secret tech.
Yes.
Where if you are sliding and you do a little, like, pivot, you can do a backflip. This is similar to the backflips in Mario where you, like, hold a direction and then flick the other direction and jump.
Yeah.
To sort of jump while turning around.
Yeah, Mario, like, skids and then does, like, a wahoo, and he does a higher jump.
But if you do that out of a slide, you can gain even more height. And there's a lot of ways you can do this. With the perfect timing, it gets, like, a yellow after trail, and it's really cool, and you go high and fast. But you can do this, like, the easiest way to do it is to do one of those jumps out of a slide, and then, as it's ending, hold the opposite direction and jump. Whereas, like, speedrunners can do it much quicker and earlier without that jump out of slide.
Yeah.
Which leads me to the movement. It is kind of cliche to say that a game has good movement, because, like, I think that's something a lot of platformer devs just want to do. Because platforming is games about movement, where, like, movement is your main interaction with the world. That's often the axis that you're tested on. And that is where, like, a lot of the inputs and mechanics go into. So, like, having good movement is kind of akin to having a good platformer. I mean, there are games with bad movement that are fun still, but I wouldn't say a lot of those have bad movement and are fun because of the platforming.
Yeah.
Or, like, if it is, it's not quite the same. Like, Castlevania, I would say, has, like, classic Castlevania, like, yeah. One, has, I would say, has bad movement, but it's fun because it becomes more of a strategy. You have to have a plan when you jump and move and stuff.
Yeah, which it makes every action, you know, it have weight.
Yeah, but, like, that's not the same as a, like, fluid platformer like this, which is more about constant motion.
Yeah, constant motion, very free form. The platformer that is, like, my personal favorite in general is Hat in Time. Like, if we're just talking specific movement mm-hmm. tech that I enjoy, like, Hat in Time is the game that really got me to love Trigger as Dash. It's the game that also, like, reignited a lot of my love for a lot of 2D or 3D platformers. And, like, the core movement of a platformer is so incredibly fucking important because, like, if you don't have that core down, what are we doing here?
Yeah,
you know?
If that is the main part of the game, then you want it to be good. It's like saying the gunplay in a shooter is good.
Yeah,
like, yeah,
exactly.
I hope it is, because if it's not, there's got to be some other meat on that, you know, sandwich.
Movement platformer ahead. Yeah, I sure hope it has movement.
I think my favorite 3D platformer in terms of just pure movement tech is Sonic Adventures 1 and 2. Adventure 1 has some, like, Mario World-esque gravity manipulation, which is fucking weird. But Adventure 2 has the bounce bracelet, which both leads to super bounce, which is a ton of height, and just, like, being able to drop quickly and then attack out of that, or, like, you know, dash out of it, which lets you move fast. And that one's also just really free form. But, like,
oh, one quick thing, by the way. I want to make a called shot. I made this a while ago while we were just hanging out. I want to make a called shot. Within the next, I'm going to say, 3 years, there will be a full decompilation of Sonic Adventure 1 or 2. Probably 2. And we are going to see the equivalent of plopping Mario into Blender, but it will be plopping Sonic into Blender.
See, my thing is that I had my own response to it. I'm not going to get into it right now. It's not important.
That's a called shot. I've been very wrong about most called shots, but I keep making them just in case.
So in Pseudoregalia, you can chain the moves together really easily, which is great. Like, for example, just being in air, you can kick, and then if you hit something, you can kick again, or you can do, like, the ground slam backflip. The ground slam, you can chain into the big jump off of it, or, like, it's very freeform in that regard. There's, like, there's not a lot of recovery frames, to use, like, a fighting game term. You're not locked into the after effects of a move often.
Yeah.
Things are quick to happen, and then you're quick to gain control again afterwards. And then also momentum is carried through so many things. You mentioned the wall kicks, and that's just, like, a great example of how the kicks carry momentum if you do them early. So you can keep your forward momentum faster by kicking in midair.
Yeah.
That's just a really solid thing, because it lets you be like, okay, I want to go fast, so I can go fast. And then now that I'm going fast, I can continue to go this speed or a similar speed.
This is also a really interesting game, because notably absent from this is a true double jump. There are equivalents to double jump. Like you said, the, like, somersault you can do in the middle of the air is basically a double jump. But, like, in terms of the archetypical double jump that, like, you know, gives you a very high amount of control over your aerial movement, you still have a high amount of control over your aerial movement. But when you are in the air, it is very hard to continue gaining height without landing first. And that is really critical for like a lot of the level design. Like, the game usually limits you based on how high you can actually go. And the game does have movement, like we've already said, to go a lot higher. But, like, in casual playthrough, the amount of distance you can actually get up, you can mark echoes getting up, is, like, really tightly controlled and, you know, usually, like, gives you a specific set path through the level.
You know, it's interesting because in terms of the overall world layout, the levels aren't very parallel or on the same floor as each other.
Yes.
If we think of this as one big building, so there is Castle Sansa, which is the main area that you're in through the early game, the like belfry, which is sort of this ledge outdoor area, and some of the theater are all on the same floor level.
Yeah.
Then there is the underbelly and dilapidated dungeon, which are lower levels, Sansa Keep, which is a higher level, and the tower ruins, which are higher than Sansa Castle and go even higher, but they're also kind of their own place. They're separated.
Well, they're through the, oh gosh, what's the name of it? The area that's like the big outside.
Yeah, it's connected
area.
To that, the belfry.
The belfry?
It's connected to that.
It's not called the belfry.
Is it?
No, it's, oh gosh.
Okay, we looked it up. It's called the Empty Bailey, not Belfry, Bailey.
Bailey.
There is a belfry in the Bailey with a bell. However, that's not the entire area.
And I don't want to explore the empty belfry. Let me be perfectly clear.
Yeah, but the tower remains is apparently what it's called. We're looking at the map now. Is across like a bridge.
We'll get to the fucking map, by the way.
Yeah, it's across a bridge. So like you don't really like. It's not really the same building.
Yeah.
What I mean is that this is a very vertical building. The Twilight Theater is kind of connected to like multiple floors in a weird way. But for the most part, the actual world itself is a castle that is split vertically rather than wide, which I think a lot of platformers do, because usually in platformers, moving horizontally is easier than moving vertically.
Yep.
And it's just important to note that that is kept in this game.
Yes.
I think, though, like, vertical movement's really possible when there are corners or walls that are close together.
Yes.
Thanks to, like, the wall jumps, and then there's some other tech that is not completely intended. And so, like, there are a lot of options for moving upward once you've gotten more upgrades. And I think that leads to a lot of really cool moments where a level that seems very limited suddenly becomes way more open.
Yeah.
You could skip all these challenges beforehand. Because, like, once you get the wall kicks and the stride breaker, the super jump from it especially, you can just kind of go anywhere within the main Castle Sansa area. You can skip a lot of early challenges. And that's really neat. There's a genuine sense of, like, conquering and progression as some things become very small and some suddenly open up and they're very big because they're really difficult.
One of my favorite feelings is being at a very high point in a level and knowing where I want to go at a lower point and being able to get there in basically just one, like, slide jump kick combo, you know?
Yeah.
Like, just being able to yeet myself out of a ledge, fall, kick, and then just end up exactly where I want to be is a massive power trip in this game.
It's great. One thing that's kind of fun about this is it's pretty easy to get out of bounds in this game.
Yeah.
I think especially in a few places, the Castle Sansa area with the bridge that's above you, that place is very easy to get out of bounds. There's a few areas in the Twilight Theater that let you get out of bounds fairly easily.
There's an area in the underbelly where you can get bonked out of bounds.
And in Twilight Theater. Because an elevator crushes you. If you're trying to look for out-of-bounds clips in games, get your head crushed by the ceiling.
True.
In the game, not in real life.
Oh.
And then there is a spot apparently in Sansa Keep that just doesn't have a ceiling in part of it, and you can just jump out of it.
Which is great. I love it.
I think, like, I want to get to this concept of, like, speedrun ability. It's not a huge discussion in terms of game design, but this is something I see a lot just because I'm in speedrun communities, which is what makes a game speedrunnable. And in a different way, or more specifically, how can a developer make a game that is good to speedrun? And it's different because there are different types of speedruns and the people that like some won't like others. Like, some people like wrong warps and credits warps, and it's kind of hard to intentionally put those in.
Yeah.
Because to those people, it's often about the spectacle of breaking a game beyond intention. And then there's people who like glitchless, and so they might just want a game that has a fun sequence of events or looks fun to watch but doesn't have many glitches. I think generally the, like, main thing with glitches is that, like, if it's hard to come by in just regular casual gameplay, then it's probably fine. And that's kind of how Pseudo-Regalia feels, is, like, it's easy to get out of bounds, but only if you are trying to get out of bounds.
Yeah.
I had to, like, really try for, like, 30 minutes to get out of bounds in that area in Castle Sansa, And when I did, I was like, oh my god, this is great. I love this. It didn't really accomplish anything, but like, I had to try really hard to do that and mess around. But because I had that freedom to do it, it worked. Another one that I see a lot is what I call the pro gamer shortcut, which is essentially an intentional shortcut that is so, like, obscured or weird, or just, like, requires some knowledge that the player doesn't know at the start of the game, but on subsequent playthroughs can access.
Yeah.
This one has it in sort of two ways in the same shortcut, where the dilapidated dungeon where you start has a breakable wall that doesn't look like a breakable wall. It doesn't have, like, cracks or anything, at least from the side that is visible to the player at the start.
Yeah.
But you can break it open either way, and behind it is a room that's pitch black, and you normally need that, like, flashlight ability to actually see. But if you know where the platforms are and where the exits are, you can get through there without needing that. So, combined, you have two layers of not knowing that a new player will have, but an experienced player can start a new game and use that shortcut and go through there, which opens up all these other routes. A similar thing is the Kraid quick kill in Metroid Dread.
Yeah.
Which requires using a sort of obscured niche movement trick where you use coyote frames to jump off of a sliding off of a ledge and use that to clear a gap earlier than you're supposed to. And then that lets you get the bombs before you're supposed to, which leads to an Easter egg quick kill against one of the bosses. But that all is intentional and in put in by the devs, but it does require this sort of niche interaction of mechanics.
Yeah.
So, like, sometimes it's just that you need a knowledge of deeper mechanics you might not get early on in the game, but as you play further, you'll have a better grasp.
Yeah.
And in this game, the, like, super jumps from the sliding position are kind of like that. There's a few things you can skip, or at least, like, challenges you can circumvent using that.
Yeah. This is definitely kind of like a Mario 64-style experience, where, like, you know, Mario 64, for example, doesn't specifically tell you about a lot of the moves you can do. It doesn't necessarily tell you about the triple jump, doesn't necessarily tell you about, like, the side jump, not at the very beginning, at least. But, like, if you know those moves, they are always available to you.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a couple of, like, you know, little things like that where, you know, once you get the ability to actually dash around and move and stuff, you have the options available to you that you can just actually do at any point. But you wouldn't know that until you fucking have them.
Yeah. And then I think also, personally, I really like routing challenges in games.
Yeah.
And this being a Metroidvania where you can pretty much go wherever once you get the first few upgrades, it is completely routing challenge in terms of the speedrun. Of like, okay, we know where all these upgrades are. What's the fastest route to get them in what order? Generally, the upgrades aren't just like in the middle. They're usually like part of a specific pathway that you have to take. Like, you go through a hallway that's a one-way road, essentially. You get the upgrade, and then you leave through another hallway that gives you a brief guide on the upgrade's uses. You know, you get the wall cling, or the wall kicks, but the door closes behind you, so you have to go through the room that teaches you, like, here's how to wall kick across a gap, here's how to wall kick upwards, you know? But even then, like, there's still a lot of options to get there. And then I think the big thing about Pseudo-Regalia is that it feels very apathetic to how the player does something.
Yeah. Like, there's a kind of, like, playground aspect of, like, you know, it presents a challenge, but it doesn't really force your hand, especially once you have even a lot of, like, the mid-game stuff. Once you really have the dash jump and the kicks, you kind of have, like, I guess the only other thing you would specifically need is the ground pound.
Mm-hmm.
I use that a lot for the vertical momentum.
Yeah.
But, like, once you have a lot of those basic tools, you just kind of can do most of the cool stuff. Like,
yeah, there's not a lot of, like, invisible walls, and there aren't many, like, story flags that check whether you actually have a specific thing. It's, like, the only thing that matters for getting to the boss fight is whether you have the keys and whether you can stand in front of the door to the final boss.
Yeah.
That's it. And even then, a lot of the keys have multiple ways to get them. There's one in the underbelly that sucks because yes. It requires like 3 upgrades, but you don't know that at the time.
It's the last key that you can get, I believe. It's
usually, like, yeah.
You're probably going to get it last because I believe it requires... It requires two specific abilities that you would have probably already gotten if you've gotten 2 other keys, basically. Yeah.
It requires at least the, like, air bonk that lets you bounce off of things, and the projectile, which then requires the charge attack.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's available pretty late, and... I didn't realize that I needed all those at first, because I thought, like, oh, I just got to jump to that one, without realizing the switch I had to hit was too far.
I went back to the underbelly 3 different times. The first time I walked in and went, I'm never going to be able to do this with my current abilities. I still gave it a try, failed. I came back with the ability that bonks you up when you, attack. And then got to the section that requires the projectile and went, I can't clear this. I can't clear this. Hang on. There's some bullshit I'm missing, aren't I? And there was some bullshit I was missing.
Yeah. But so, a coward game dev who is unconfident in their design would put a big door that you have to open in front of the key.
Yeah.
This game does not have a big door. It has a bridge that comes up from like the lava beneath. But if you could somehow cross that gap without turning the bridge on, you could still get the key.
Yes. Your point about, like, the speedrun ability, I think, is really salient with this game, because I feel like there is a special place in hell. There's a special place for, like, games that slowly turn you into a speedrunner for that game. Stuff like Celeste, where you start off, you know, even from my understanding, from other people I've heard, even people who don't necessarily do, you know, high-tech platformer speedruns, play that game, and it just sort of, like, really slowly introduces you to what eventually becomes the tech. And Pseudoregalia is a fun enough platformer that there were multiple times where I was like, I bet I could just completely cheese this. And there were multiple times where I succeeded.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there were times where I realized that a platform I needed to get on was just really close to a corner. And I was like, well, hang on. If I just launch myself towards this corner, I could probably, you know, 3 kicks up and succeed it. And then 3 attempts later, I do it. And I'm like, oh, I'm good at video games.
Yeah, I think modern day platformers for like enthusiasts kind of end up going in 2 directions. There are the not quite puzzle platformers where there is a intended solution to a room. I would say Celeste kind of is one of those for the most part.
Yeah.
As well as like The End Is Nigh, which is a fantastic game and often forgotten in terms of Edmund McMillan's gamography. Ludography, I don't know. But and then you have like the very open sandboxes or playgrounds where you're given a bunch of tools and then a challenge that doesn't have a clear objective, but your tools can combine in some way.
Yeah.
The, like, primo example of this is Mosalina, which is the roguelite platformer, where you're given literally random tools to use in each level, and you have to find a cool way to get to the exit. Yeah, a lot of 3D platformers have kind of gone that direction, I think, especially because Mario 64 is so prevalent. Like, Mario 64 is still one of the biggest speedrun games.
Yeah.
A big part of that is a mix of the freeform movement, the way that moves chain together, the way that the levels are designed to provide multiple routes to a goal. And, I mean, there's tons of sequence breaking even before you get to things like BLJs.
Yeah.
And the fact that you can complete so many things in any order. Like, even though Pseudoregalia is not really a collectathon, it still carries all of those DNA sort of codes, you know.
Yeah,
it's got the GATC, the Gattaca. It's cool. However, there is one big thing at release that a lot of people were not a big fan of, which is that there was no map.
It was missing one particularly key element:
a map.
Okay, so I have some criticisms of Pseudoregalia.
Yes,
number 1 was the map.
Mm-hmm.
I now, for clarity, I played this game pre-map update. I played it post-map update on the Steam Deck primarily. I still did not get the map. The map is early on in the Dilapidated Dungeon, but if you're already in the middle of a run, you would have to go and get it.
Yeah.
But when I was on my big search for the last key, basically, I went through the Dilapidated Dungeon multiple times, and I never found the goddamn map.
Yeah.
And so, it's something where I understand the intent of, like, learn the levels five head, and I wouldn't even say, like, I phrase it like that as a joke. I don't think the game is like, you know, trying to force me into, you know, oh, you just have to learn the levels. However, I think it's just like a convergent thing of like, it was a small project made by one person who didn't need the map. I think about that a lot. There's a Total Biscuit line. Rest in peace. There was a Total Biscuit video where he talked about essentially accessibility and settings options and stuff, because he was a big proponent of, you know, big settings option lists. And he made an interesting point, which was like, you know, there was a hard roguelite where the developer literally didn't even have a save function at release because the developer didn't, you know, like, played it enough that they didn't need it, and so they didn't think to add it. And so, like, I am almost certain this is a similar situation where, like, the developer made this game and they made it how they wanted it to, but, like, on release, a lot of people were like, hey, it would be a lot easier to move if we had a map. And the dev was probably like, oh shit, yeah.
Yeah, the map was added into a new room that was put pretty early in the game. It's right after you leave the Dilapidated Dungeon in like the first room of Castle Sansa. There's a ramp that goes up, there's an NPC that you can talk to, and then to the right is a room that has the map. When I opened the game up to play it in preparation for this, I didn't know where the map was, so I kept walking around, and every time I would try to look at the map in the menu, it just says, like, my memory is hazy, and I'm like, yeah. Is this, like, a new file thing? No, it's just in a room that's new. And I knew it was there because when I saw that doorway, I just thought, oh, that wasn't there before. And there were a few things like that when I started playing again.
Yeah.
I played it pre-map update and played it all the way through, got almost everything. Maybe missing one or two, like, small keys and rooms that are unlocked by those. I think, like, I was able to navigate okay, especially sort of as I went through the same areas over and over. I picked up on a few main, like, through routes. The main one is from the Empty Bailey. There's, like, a ramp that goes into Castle Sansa, and then there's this big room that looks different from other rooms, and at the top, you could go up some stairs to reach the Sansa Keep, and, like, that pathway between them, I got so used to taking, but, like, there are so many little corners and hallways that look very similar. There's not a lot of, like, different tile sets, really, or, like, textures, I guess, in this case. I think, like, with a bit more visual differences, it would be a bit easier.
Yeah.
Because, like, there's almost every room in the Castle Sansa area has the same color palette and textures for, like, the floors and walls and whatnot. And there are some rooms that have very unique layouts. Like, there is the one that leads to the library, which has a bunch of stuff that moves up and down. There's the T intersection. You know, there's those. But, like, there's a lot of corners and, like, corridors you move through very quickly that I get mixed up all the time because I'm like, I know there's something between here and the next landmark, but I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
It's like, have you ever driven to somewhere a lot? But then, like, can you say for certain what every shop in the strip mall from, like, this stoplight to the next one is?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I am driving past the strip malls to reach the McDonald's, and I know that I know where the McDonald's is, and I know that I am currently at my house, but there's three strip malls in between there, and I don't know which one is which, but the moment I have to go to one of those strip malls, I'm fucked.
The game tries to visually style it up, like, Okay, the best example I can think of is, I think it is Samsa Keep, has a, like, very white checkerboard. It's, like, white and gray, whereas Twilight Theater has, like, a very red checkerboard.
You've got it backwards.
I've got it backwards.
The Keep has red checkerboard, Samsa Castle has white checkerboard, Twilight Theater has yellow checkerboard.
Gotcha. Yeah, and so it's like, it is three checkerboards. The color itself does kind of add to it, but at the same time, like, it's something where if this were on an actual N64, I would look at it and be like, oh, that's kind of a neat, you know, way to skirt that limitation.
But that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the fact that if you're in Castle Sansa, every room has white checkerboard.
Okay,
it's a huge fucking place, and the rooms look so similar in certain areas. Like, there is that crossroads I mentioned. I cannot tell you which direction goes which way, because it's all crossroads.
Yeah, you're talking about, like, the literal in, you know, in each individual area, the different, there isn't really a different color palette and such.
So, like, the terrain can kind of blend together. And like I said, there are landmarks. Like, in Sansa Castle, there's a few big areas, almost like hubs, that branch off from there. But those branches, I don't know which branch is which most of the time.
Yeah.
And so navigating it can be really tricky. And I like to think I'm really good at navigating things. But, like, it just kind of falls short. And so the map does feel very helpful and maybe a necessity. I do wish there was, like, some sort of fast travel, just because getting between different areas is kind of tough. And I ended up backtracking a lot.
Yeah, travel to Crystal would have been kind of nice.
I think the reason that key in the dilapidated dungeon sucks is because you have to go through a little platforming challenge to reach it.
Yes.
But then once you get there, if you realize you can't progress, you have to leave and then choose a direction to leave the dilapidated dungeon from.
The hardest part of the dilapidated dungeon, or not the dilapidated dungeon, the underbelly key, was not the actual...
That's
like,
what underbelly, yeah.
Yeah, was not the actual key challenge itself. It was getting to it. Because I did it the first time, because I essentially went... Not backwards, but I went in the entrance that gets you to that area a lot quicker. And then I couldn't find that entrance again. So I just had to go through the entire underbelly multiple times.
Yeah.
And, like, at a certain point, it crossed the threshold of, like, you know, neat and, oh, I'm, you know, zooming through all of this, and became, where the hell is that goddamn room?
Yeah. Maps are interesting in games because, like, in traditional games, drawing maps was considered a part of playing the game. Like, think of the original Legend of Zelda. People drew maps for that game because there was no in-game world map.
I would even go earlier and be like, you know, NES era
or like Adventure. Yeah, you know, on Atari 2600.
Yeah, like, for having a pen and paper was expected for a lot of video games.
And I will say that when I play certain puzzle games, I will readily keep pen and paper. Like, I love a pen and paper puzzle game.
Yeah.
Which is to say, like, Tunic or La Mulana. Like, I love having a notebook when I play a puzzle game because I have to, like, keep track of info and stuff like that. That's my jam. But for some reason, I think maps have fallen out of favor, and I think part of that's because game worlds have gotten more complex, that they're harder to render on pieces of paper. So, like, because of the three-dimensionality of a 3D platformer, vertical space is a thing. How do you represent that on a hand-drawn map? Like, on a 2D map, you could have, like, multiple floors, you could just have it overlap in certain ways, but, like, it can get kind of complicated.
Yeah.
And I think having a video game map just means there is a canonical way to represent the space to an observer.
Yeah.
And that kind of makes it easier to parse certain things like entrances or exits. And I don't know, like, certain elements of it are probably just a lot harder to make by hand.
Yeah.
There's also the fact that you are an over-the-shoulder perspective instead of a top-down omniscient. And so what you can actually perceive is different. It's a lot easier to chart out a space that you can see entirely with your eyes. So, like, in Super Metroid, it wouldn't be too hard to make that map by hand, because you're just drawing the screens you're in. But Metroid Prime is way harder, because you have a very limited view of the world you're in.
Yeah.
Pseudo Regalia is somewhere between the two, where you are limited by the perspective, but it's not first person, so there's a bit more leeway. But still, it's hard to fully understand the space.
Yeah, the dungeon style, like the dungeon, you know, building style of interconnectedness is handy for active traversal. It is handy for the active, like, puzzle solving. I really liked Twilight Theater because a lot of the areas you had to go would loop in on the center room, and so you had a definitive endpoint of like, okay, I have gone through this path, I need to find the next path. And so, you know, it has its benefits. I think that I will say, like, it did have the benefits. This game, I think, has the benefit of that, where, like, you know, realistically every room has just a couple of exits. But it also has the problem of having, like, just a couple of rooms that have five exits, you know? The underbelly is another example here. I didn't really like the underbelly section, yeah, I'm sorry.
It wasn't even, like, it was not scary.
Like, I got there and I was like, oh, I'm in the shit pit. But then I went, wait, this is pseudo regalia. The scariest thing I'm gonna face is, I don't know, a maid with no head. But, like,
that's not scary in the slightest.
True. Especially if she has, like, a flame head.
Yeah,
that's
like a
cool
Dullahan?
Yeah.
Dullahan maid? Now, for later?
Now her plates, though. Fuck them.
Yeah.
When you come into a room that has, you know, a bunch of different exits, and one of them is forward progress, and four of them are an entire winding corridor, like, even if you have the map, like, the map certainly would be very helpful, but, like, you know, even if you have the map at a certain point, you kind of get lost.
Yeah.
But, again, I wouldn't hold that necessarily the biggest against this game. I understand that part of the point is that it is built to be speedrun, it is built to be replayed, and it is, so it is kind of built for you to learn the layout through repetition.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is fair and valid. But I do also generally think that, yeah, a map would have been nice at launch.
Yeah. So, there's one big part of the game, well, not big, but there's a part of the game we've not touched at all, because it's not really there, is the story. This game doesn't really have much of a story. I can say it in a few sentences, which is that there's a bunch of these little goat dudes. These just little guys.
Yeah, they're greatest little guys. I want them on a marketable plushie.
And they keep mentioning something about the haze that is affecting the world. And they also mentioned that there is a princess that is locked up in the tower remnants, or the tower remains. That's the third R word I've said. Uh-oh.
Oh, no.
Don't take that out of context. But once you get the five keys, you can unlock the door to the princess and wake her or something like that.
Yeah.
It's very vague. There are, I think, sort of allusions to, like, Alice in Wonderland with the rabbit aspect.
Yeah.
There's allusions to, like, Cinderella or Sleeping Beauty with the sleeping aspect.
There's religious symbolism very deeply.
Oh, yeah, with the cross, like, and yeah, the nun outfit.
The nun outfit, the cross, the, like, cheruby look on the eggs, honestly.
Yeah.
The, like, hand itself also feels very Hand of God-y.
Mm-hmm.
That could be reading into it, of course.
And then there are, of course, dream aspects. The eggs look like the dudes from Nights into Dreams.
Yep, yep.
The not chow. The world itself, I think this is really... Okay, so essentially what it is spoilers for the ending of Pseudo Regalia. You're in a dream, but it's someone else's dream.
Oh, shit.
The princess is someone who is asleep in maybe a coma, maybe just sleeping.
Maybe just in real life.
And you have to wake her up by fighting her. I don't know if she has an axe blade at the end of her ponytail in real life.
Yeah.
Or if that's just a cool thing she has in the dream.
She's actually a fighting game character.
Pretty much. It feels like that. She's like a fighting game character who wandered her way in here.
Wait, this is just a Guilty Gear character, actually.
Yeah, pretty much. And so, like... You fight her, she wakes up, she says, like, she'll get into photography, maybe.
Yeah, she like, the ending text crawl is basically like, oh, fine, I guess I will get up. Maybe I'll actually, like, get into photography. What's your name, Sybil? Well, hey, thanks for getting me up, weird cat, goat, bunny lady.
Yeah. It feels sort of like someone who is just, I think, depressed and is sleeping to avoid everything.
Yeah.
And sort of being forced awake. There is some weird side comments.
Yet another quirky indie RPG about depression. Sorry.
Yeah, there are some side comments by some of the NPCs, though. Like, they say that Sybil is wearing a disguise. I don't know what that means.
I think it's that she is dressed like the little dudes, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, yeah, the first guy that you're likely to meet is one of them who is in a cage. And he's like, you know, it's a decent disguise. You know, it won't fool me, but it'll probably fool the rest of them. And it's like, okay, but if I'm not disguised, what are you going to do? Yeah. I can punt you. You're a tiny little guy.
Yeah, Sybil's like 3 times taller than them.
Yeah.
I thought it was that, like, because, like, they're, the fur color of those little guys is the same as Sybil's fur.
Yeah.
I was under some headcanon impression that she was, like, a wandering spirit within dreams that takes a form depending on who the dreamer is to fit in with the said dream.
I wouldn't even say that's out of the realm of possibility, because at the end, like, the person who is dreaming has a comment that's like, you know, it's something like, oh, you've probably got places to be.
Yeah.
And so it does kind of feel like that thing where Sybil is, you know, secretly the high lore feels like Sybil is some kind of wandering spirit who gets into people's dreams and is and helps them out in some way.
Yeah, by beating them up with a big cross. Up. I also want to point out there is an area of Sansa Keep, which is in one of the entrances from Castle Sansa, that the floor textures are on the walls and the ceiling as well.
Yeah.
To make it look sort of like a in-development area, or like a beta area. And the goat NPC in that room has like
a few letters
separated by dots.
He also has like no texture, or like a washed out texture.
Yeah,
like he's, you know, trying to say something that's barely not getting through.
Yeah,
and it's the only room in the game like that.
And then also in the theater, behind a little alley creek nook in some boxes, there's a goat who's like, I'm hiding here, don't let me out, or else I might kill again.
Yeah.
So there's something weird there, and I wanna bring this up, because Pseudo-Regalia is not a creepy game. However, it does wear some aspects of that on itself.
Yes.
It has some of the aesthetics of low-poly horror, which we've sort of talked about in some ways. I think, like, we've mainly talked about this in terms of web series like Pets Cop or Via Verde.
Yes.
But this is, like, a burgeoning artistic scene in the indie game sphere.
Yeah.
Like, I think it started with, like, Puppet Combo and Kitty Horror Show, and then also with PT, but indirectly.
Yeah.
Because PT made people want to make new Silent Hill games themselves, which caused people to look towards the PS1 graphical limitations that made Silent Hill 1 and 2 so effective.
I wouldn't say it started with Kitty Horror Show and Puppet Combo, but they are basically, Puppet Combo especially, is like the most prolific PS1 style horror game creator still there, honestly. Mm-hmm. Like, there are others, and, you know, there's a lot of others, but they are like a company whose entire thing is, hey, remember PS1 style horror games? We make those now.
Yeah. And then that gave way to the PS1 demo disc, which is a scene or collective of game creators making these sort of retro horror games.
Yep.
But not every game in the collections are horror games, and a lot of them aren't really that spooky for most of it.
Yeah.
I think, like, Tori 3D and Peeb's Adventure are two main ones that are also 3D platformers with, like, very light spooky elements, but not really spooky in any way.
It does kind of feel like some of the projects in PS1 Horror Disc, like, kind of have a little bit slipped in there to make it count. But then, you know, also just really are there because it's like, yeah, it's a classic inspired sort of thing.
Right.
And that's not even a knock against them necessarily.
Right. And then, like, even things unrelated to that, but in a similar artistic style, like Anodyne 2,
yep,
have elements of this in their games as well. It is so interesting. Anodyne 2, I should mention, Anodyne 1 was inspired by Yume Nikki in some regards, and has horror elements, so it makes sense that Anodyne 2 would still have them. It's just the 3D platformer aspect of Anodyne 2 makes it stand out in this regard, and uses those sort of conventions instead of the RPG Maker horror conventions. Anyways, Pseudoregalia is not a creepy game. It has some weird elements that might be a little creepy at first, and it has like some atmosphere, but it's not really built to be a creepy game or a game that wields like an oppressive atmosphere.
Yeah. Like I said, even in the most outright spooky area of the game, the underbelly, it's mostly just like bit of atmosphere, bit of texturing, bit of music, but there really isn't anything scary.
Right.
You know, it's a little bit of the vibe of it without actually being spooky.
Yeah, there's no like evil secret ending. There's no demon that is found at the very depths. There's no jump scare. It's very calm for most of it.
Yeah.
And I think this is just very interesting because it does kind of fit with the dream setting of Pseudoregalia, that in a lot of ways, both the creepiness is there because dreams are weird and not always make sense. And also that like things like being able to go out of bounds super easily, it doesn't really feel jarring because you kind of know you're in a dream at times. And so like if you can go out of bounds, it's just another surreal aspect. But I was thinking about this. This is a bit of a very widespread macro sort of observation here. I feel like low-poly horror is very similar to analog horror, and also very similar to, like, The Caretaker. So,
okay.
I have found that imperfections in digital media, or just in media in general, are often used to represent two things, which are like dreams or like distant memories, only a distant memory.
Yeah.
A burning, whatever. But also
it's only a burning memory.
That it. But also like horror, very much so. It's that there's like a surreality to imperfections in media. Things like, I don't know, jump skips, obviously. If like a tape were to skip and go backwards, that's a very obvious, like, that's kind of like a jump scare.
Yeah.
But like crackles and pops from records and the lines and stuff from tapes, the compressed audio from old VHSs being played on like an old CRT TV.
Yeah.
These are things that are like used pretty often to evoke a distant sort of uncanny surrealness to a project. And it's interesting. It does play into the nostalgia cycle. Like if we're going by the 30-year nostalgia cycle, then that makes sense that these are a thing.
Yeah.
But also just like, I feel like nowadays media has, like especially video games, have reached a very close approximation to a realistic art style that certain 3D aspects can become so uncanny because they're now foreign to us. Like, have you looked at Glover recently? Some of the levels in Glover look like they wouldn't be out of place in Pseudoregalia.
Yeah, there's a... Oh gosh, I wish that I had a priming for this just because I know that there are games that I played where, like, they're specific... You know what it is? I finally realized quite a while ago a specific origin of horror for me, and it's fucking Rabbids. Hear me out. There were these commercials for Rabbids games where like they're standing next to a fucking cow or something, and then they go bah, and then they like take out a plunger and, you know,
plunge its ass.
Except here's the thing, they always kind of like, you know, look around a bit, and then they look at the camera, and then they do the scream, and they have this specific like, you know, shaking motion. And like, I saw that and went, oh my god, that's the origin of so many of these things. Because, like, I always got creeped out by, like, really overly digital shaking. Mm-hmm. I got creeped out by, like, silent sounds that are suddenly broken up with some kind of screaming. Which, you know, it's not necessarily only this, but you know what I mean. Like, the surreality of, like, digital placed alongside some kind of more realistic thing. So much of it is there.
Yeah.
I was just like, holy shit.
Yeah. I think it's super interesting because as, like, art movements, I think there's the dreamlike aspect of these imperfections was really prevalent in Vaporwave in similar communities.
Yeah.
Similar internet art communities of like embracing imperfection as a form of aesthetic rather than purely a negative. But with horror, it's viewing them as like a barrier between experience and fiction of like, it would be a lot easier to listen to this song if there weren't crackles to it.
Yeah,
but the crackles add this wall that makes it more obscured, more weird. In low poly games and low poly horror games, it's like the lack of a definition on like the faces makes the characters seem off. Having textures that are very blurry can make the ground seem distant and foreign and unclear what it's actually made of.
Yeah.
And then if there is a monster that is just made of like polygons and weird textures, it leaves a lot of room to actually interpret what it is. It's interesting because it plays off of also just like fundamental survival horror like Silent Hill and Resident Evil. Those were in on the PS1.
Oh, yeah.
And so, like, of course the genre is going to be attached to that because it's the classic. I do think, though, like, NES and SNES pixel art didn't have this connotation. Atari does. Because, like, think of Faith. Faith lives off of the ambiguities in the Atari pixel art.
Yeah.
And, like, the deep compression of Atari audio. But, like, the SNES and NES pixel art, like, that's more of an art style nowadays that is just a normal art style. Like, I don't feel any horror or weirdness when I play The Messenger. I'm playing a video game.
Yeah.
But it feels like because 3D graphics have gone so upward so fast, the PS1 N64 era has turned into this uncanny valley sort of force.
There's something that I was recently thinking about. There was a Nintendo commercial that somebody quote tweeted because it was a commercial about the 3DS and it was essentially pitching it as, you know, this like nostalgic thing like you do. It's the whole thing of like a guy is at school and then he goes through his old stuff and oh, there's his old 3DS. And they made an interesting point, which is that like when they show gameplay and such from that period, not specifically from the 3DS, but, like, from that period, they show it in this, like, grainy, like, projector light, and it's like, those games are HD.
Yeah.
Like, those games are HD. We had 1080p, you know, 60fps on the 3DS. Like, the age of tech, and this isn't even, you know, a controversial or, like, a new take necessarily, but, like, the age of tech got so good so fast that I cannot at all be surprised that when we really latch onto the nostalgia, you know, emphasis or like the emphasis of, you know, older graphics, we go to that specific awkward period of PS1 and N64. Because like, and you know, this comes from somebody who would love a PS2 styled horror game or like, you know, something that has that kind of weird uncanny valley fidelity of being just a little too realistic but obviously not. The PS1 does that the best. Mm-hmm. Like the PS1 and to a lesser extent the N64 do that kind of uncanny valley just the best because it was a little uncanny at the time even, but you know, it was also, you know, working within the limitations you had, and it made more interesting art when there were limitations on it, ultimately.
I think the limitations made art a certain way, and now that there's fewer limitations, I don't think it's necessarily less interesting, but there are probably certain avenues where it is less interesting. Like, I don't think Outer Wilds is less interesting because the art is more, well, I guess Outer Wilds isn't the most realistic, but you get what I mean. Like, there are interesting stories nowadays and interesting games that don't have as many limitations graphically, but that doesn't really stop it. I think nowadays, the limitations are viewed purely in terms of style and aesthetic, and Pseudo-Regalia really leans into the sort of baggage or perception that those have. Not fully the way that there is, like, weird, creepy, sort of creepypasta stuff in, like, Peeb's Adventure, but, you know, maybe to the less degree. I think overall, though, that sort of Pseudo-Regalia is, like, we talked about a lot of stuff, and, like, it is definitely speedrun friendly, but as far as the connection to, like, the low-poly horror stuff, it's only kind of there. I think this ended up being more of an episode where we kind of used
pseudo-regalia to talk about things that weren't pseudo-regalia, so hope that's fine. But if you like it and you want to hear more episodes about stuff, you can follow us on any podcasting platform you like. Give us a like, give us a comment, give us a rating, give us a review, let us know how we're doing, let us know what topics you'd want us to cover in the future, or things you think we might be interested in. You can find us on Twitter and Blue Sky at NetsurferPro, where you can message us there, or you can see teasers for upcoming episodes in the form of little emoji riddles. Try to figure them out. They're kind of tricky. I'm pretty proud of them. Try them out. You can also follow me on Twitter in Blue Sky at Twackaroo. Twackaroo on Twitter and twack.bsky.social on Blue Sky, where I post about things going on, upcoming projects, just thoughts about stuff, what have you. I was posting a ton of pinball scores, but I've kind of moved those over to Pindigo. So if you like pinball and you want to see my pinball scores, you can follow me on Pindigo under Twackaroo. You can also follow me on Twitch at twitch.tv/twack, where sometimes I stream. I'm trying to increase that now that the weather's better. I've been feeling better, and so hopefully I can get back on the swing of the stream. You can also follow Galen on Blue. This is recorded after the rest of the episode, by the way. That's why the audio is different. You can follow Galen on Twitter in Blue Sky at Galen Wilson, at GalenWilson0n. And I think that's also his TikTok. Something like that. You can follow him and hear him talk about stuff that's important to him or just important in general. And you can also follow him on Machine Gun Vampire on Twitch, where he may or may not do anything. Who knows these days, really? It's tumultuous. It's still kind of a new year. It's you know, a year for reinvention. And I'm going to reinvent the way I end this episode. See ya.